What do you think of my green mood lighting
for Godzilla?
For Godzilla. Yeah, see, that's...
I think you've thought of everything.
I am talk about production. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm all in.
So is that nuclear waste that is blowing?
I'm radioactive. Yeah. I am slowly morphing into a giant 40-story tall lizard.
A meaner version of me would have said that didn't actually take as much as he thought it did, but but like I said, a meaner version. When I say it like this,
you would never say something like
when
that.
When I say it detached like this, that removes me from the situation and then I don't have to be culpable.
Welcome to the Voyage Podcast, a show that traverses the oceans of myth and legend through the lens of Catholic theology and philosophy. Come aboard as we set sail in pursuit of the heroic life and Christian virtue. With your hosts, Mike Schramm and Jacob Platty.
You know, honestly, where would this podcast be without my fun antics? You know, you're always boring in front of a bookshelf, like some kind of like Oxford Don.
Just say it, nerd.
I mean, like, yeah, you know, you're not C.S. Lewis, Mike. You're never going to be C.S. Lewis, bro.
Oh, that hurts. Yeah, not yet.
Did you ever actually hear any audio recording of C.S. Lewis talk?
I feel like I think because they have his like his Mere Christianity.
Because
that was originally an audio.
Yeah,
that was original radio address.
Podcast, yeah.
Actually, his Four Loves. So you can find this YouTube channel called C.S. Lewis Doodle, where they'll take the transcripts. They'll play it over a hand who will be drawing like the concepts that he's talking about. And I actually use that for when we do the Four Loves, because I do the Four Loves as one of my units for my students. And so I'll use those where, you know, we'll kind of like watch and we'll pause it when he draws like this picture and he talks about this concept. Not when I say him, not C.S. Lewis. Yep. It's the guy who makes the videos. But then see, it's C.S. Lewis's voice, as far as I know it is.
Well, and so what I was getting at is like, he sounds really nerdy. Like he doesn't sound like, I want him to have like a... like rich British baritone, and instead he's like foppish. C.S. Lewis had like a foppish accent, and
you
it's
know
like,
who has a really surprising voice, especially considering his size. And like you said, you expect this like big kind of booming, but G.K. Chesterton had like a high voice. Which
I guess I could kind of see that.
I was
surprised.
They say
Abraham Lincoln had a high nasally voice.
Was it shrill? It was shrill.
Well, you watched Lincoln, right? The Spielberg flick from 10 years ago.
No,
you haven't,
seen watched
that?
Like any of those. I am
Whoa.
Not.
Ooh, hey, no. Dude, you got to go check that one out.
Oh yeah, right after I watch a million monster movies, I'll watch Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. There are a million monster movies too.
Are you talking? Is it the Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yeah, and
one?
He does an That's awesome job. Okay. And I feel like he does a good job bringing to life what Lincoln's voice is supposed to have sounded like. So anyway,
will my mind be blown,
content,
Jacob? If I watch it, will my mind be blown if I watch that Lincoln
too
movie?
Soon? Too soon?
Oh, what?
I don't 200, know.
200 years isn't enough time. Are you a great-great-grandson and that I just offended your great-great-grandpa?
That was some pretty dark humor. But you know what was also full of dark humor? 1954's Godzilla.
Oh, really? What a transition. I felt so natural. I mean, honestly, I would have never made that transition. So why don't you take us away, Jacob? Welcome to this... Let me welcome our loyal fan base, our viewers and listeners to this episode of the Voyage Podcast, where, just sort of not just in response to the 5 million monster movies that have come out in the last 5 years, but the most recent of those is Godzilla X Kong, or is Godzilla by Kong, or is it Godzilla
Times Kong? Can we go back to using English in our movie titles,
please? How many rows of Godzilla... with Kong, like what's the product of that math equation?
Yeah,
but anyway,
I don't know.
So Godzilla X Kong equals Jesus. That's what the title is going to be, right? That's good.
What I'm going to call this Godzilla V Kong X Christ.
to the Spirit's power. To the Holy Spirit power. what other order of operations?
It'd have to be cubed because of the Trinity.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Yes. So what? Yeah. How many order of operations can we fit in there? But anyway, so we're going to talk about. I mean, it's going to be about a lot of the sort of monster movies and again the common themes, because that's always the thing that at least what I think is most interesting is we can take all of these different properties. And you might tell us a story of like one of these movies or one of these stories, but then how do we find that common thread, that common theme amongst all of them? And that's what we're going to kind of get into for the most part, right?
Well, and I've been a big fan of Godzilla my entire life. Like some of the earliest VHSs that I had were actually old Godzilla movies. So some of my earliest memories are of being probably like 4 years old watching.
Are you recording this from your retirement home, Jacob? Is that where you're...
My big green radioactive retirement home under the sea, because as we discovered in 2019, that's where Godzilla goes to retire.
That's the place of the underworld. That makes sense.
It does. And we're going to get into that. I love Godzilla. I've loved Godzilla my entire life and also grew up watching King Kong as well. So this is another Jacob episode, basically. Where it's like, I'm pretty excited about this franchise and these movies.
You know what? You've been doing all the background work, so I'm just going to let it. I'm not even going to complain. I'm just going to.
We sure have switched roles, haven't we?
I'm going to be a gracious guest. I'm going to be a gracious guest.
You're going to sit there and just pick apart and make fun of the thing that I'm, you know, hold close to my heart, right? So that's how this feels. That's how this feels.
Yeah, we've had a little bit of that. We Freaky Friday'd a little bit, haven't we?
We did. It feels like that. It's like all the episodes are all just stuff I want to talk about now. These are cool. These are cool properties. I can't promise you the quality of any given movie you're going to watch is going to be like high end, top grade quality. But you know what? They sure are a lot of fun.
Well, and this is more of the Monster Godzilla and the Monster King Kong, right? Is that kind of the
question?
Well, maybe the question mark should be after the Godzilla too. Is Godzilla the monster? Who's the real monster, Jacob?
Maybe it's us, Mike. Maybe we're.
Maybe it was us the whole time.
Whoa!
It was the friends we made along the way, or the
Call
bonds
back
we
to
built.
Our zombie episode, yeah. You know,
or like every movie nowadays is just taking a conventional monster and making it a mirror to all of us. I mean, isn't that Frankenstein? Isn't that
It's almost like it's been played out, but
honestly though, isn't that the role of the, I know I'm kind of riffing a little bit, but like that's the author is it's taking the unexpected. It's the mirror that we would have never accepted if it was just, hey, you're doing a bad thing or you're being a bad guy, or this is a bad part of humanity or, you know, a difficult part with humanity, but it's dressing it up in this way that's presentable or acceptable. So it's like, if I just told you, hey, lust is really bad. Lust sucks the life out of the romantic partner. You know, then that's you're not going to want to accept that. But if I showed you Dracula doing it,
you shouldn't kidnap blonde bombshells and they take them to your giant mountaintop cave full of bones.
We're sick of that message. We've heard all that.
But
if I showed you Dracula doing it and you're like, oh, what a monster, and be like, oh, so that's a bad thing. You agree with me. It's a thing to. So anyway.
What you're really getting into is a lot of the themes from King Kong itself, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's actually where I want to start is talking about King Kong and how he's been played across movies in time or whatever. And then we'll get into Godzilla and then we'll kind of wrap up with like, you know, common themes from the two. I've seen all of these movies many, many times.
I've started all of these movies many times.
Many, many times.
This is a little insight into Jacob and my text conversations when we're planning episodes you should really watch this one. And I'll text him the next morning. I started it.
Mike never follows through. Evidently, he is just not captivated by these kaiju films. But, you'll come around one of these days.
And the thing is I generally trust your recommendations. It's just, you know, circumstances being what
they
are.
They just keep biting you because they're good. I love King Kong. I love the original 1933 King Kong. And I think what's really cool about King Kong, the 33 movie, is how, no pun intended, it's really quite timeless for what it is. You know, if you actually do get around to watching this movie these days, Mike, I think you'll find that it's surprisingly engaging for something that came out almost 100 years ago. And the actual special effects using and things like that, obviously you're looking at like a, you know, a stop motion Kong character, but he's full of character and full of life. And the different techniques they use must have blown people's minds.
It's not like a marionette puppet. It's not like a
marionette. He's not on strings.
Yeah. Or, you know, like the planes that are flying around King Kong is like, you can see the string that they're
kind of pulling. Right?
It's like a mobile over a baby's crib. It actually would be a really fun idea for a mobile, actually, is you have King Kong in the middle on an Empire State Building, like, and then the one flies around it on the planes. Yeah.
Wow. That's actually genius.
If you found that on Etsy, you would buy that. Yeah. If you saw that on Etsy, you'd buy it for your baby still needs it.
Yeah. I still got kids.
You wouldn't even waste that on your own little kid. You put it over your own bed.
Yeah. I would put that over my own bed. Yeah. Right. Like, come on.
Be like, so cool.
You know, so what's interesting is that King Kong came out in 1933 and then in 20 years is when 1954 Godzilla comes out, right? And so I think that when you watch the original King Kong and the original Godzilla, there's this, a crazy amount has happened in history, basically, between 1933 and 1954.
You don't say.
And, yeah, you know, you that was kind of, sound of some big history years, you know. And you can see that the themes are very similar to each other in these two movies. But humankind is at a very different place in its like engagement with reality circa 1954, right? And the fact that one of these is told from, you know, basically a Western American perspective with King Kong pre-World War II. And the other one is told from a Japanese perspective post-World War II. Also kind of flavors these two movies, you know? King Kong as a movie belongs to this kind of lost world genre, right? Which was really, really popular in kind of pulp fiction at the time. Kind of started out with Jules Verne a little bit, right? But, you know, he did Journey to the Center of the Earth, things like that. But by the time you get to the actual 20th century, you have Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and you have Edgar Rice Burroughs and things like that. And they are popularizing, you know, Conan Doyle wrote The Lost World, right? And then Burroughs, he wrote The Land That Time Forgot. And there's also another riff on Going to the Center of the Earth, which is At the Earth's Core by Rice Burroughs. And I've read many of these kind of pulp novels from back in the day. I really enjoyed them. They're just really imaginative and fun. But that's what King Kong is. King Kong is a big screen version of this really popular form of chop that was, you know, present at the time. And it has all the notes. It has all the notes of it.
Well, and what I was thinking, because you mentioned Jules Verne, who you did Journey to the Center of the Earth, which is Jules Verne, right?
That's true. Yeah.
And then he also did Around the World in 80 Days. And so his, like, a lot of the stuff that he does in his sort of, like, almost like proto sci-fi, I mean, because this is also around the same time that The Time Machine is being written by H.G. Wells, is right. It's sort of this, like, around the Industrial Revolution, like, modernity, like, man is the measure of all things, like, we're going to, you know, tackle the, we're going to put nature on the rack. And so, and I was even thinking, like, King Kong is sort of the response to the, you know, World War One and sort of the crumbling of that modern kind of mindset that man is the measure. And like you said, we kind of joked about before, maybe man is actually the problem. There's another short story called by E.M. Forster called The Machine Stops, which was written in I can't remember the exact year, but it's early 1900s as well. And it's a lot of these, those similar sort of ideas or similar themes.
Especially King Kong, and this will get really interesting when we really get into the themes of it. That he is actually both a kind of representation of humanity, and also at the same time a representation of like nature, bigger than humanity and things like that. So when you start to explore what's happening in the King Kong story, your empathy is constantly is flipping back and forth between the human characters and the Kong character. And the movie does this balancing act, this juggle between those two perspectives. But I actually think is, you know, maybe Frankenstein's the only other kind of movie that like has that same level of like you both sympathize and are horrified at, you know, the main creature kind of thing. Most of the time, it's pretty hard for there to be as much of a balance between revulsion and empathy.
People complain nowadays about complicated bad guys, how it's like, you know, it's not. But it's like we've been having complicated bad guys. And again, quote unquote, bad guys for over, how far back does Frankenstein go? Like 150 years. Right? Yep.
So and it's not even like, you know, someone like the Joker, he's a popular bad guy because he's fun to watch and fun to see what he does next. But he's not empathetic. You know, if you actually want to be or if you actually care about the Joker in some kind of like compassionate sense,
you're the problem. Yeah.
You're the problem. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
well, that,
like,
people
fun,
made that comment
not,
when the Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie came out, where it's like the fact that it was $1 billion because it resonated with humanity, but did it in the way that it was supposed to, you know, and I say the intention of the director or the author.
Right. Well, all right. So, the only other kind of introductory statement I want to make before we get into this is that there's this interesting idea that both King Kong and Godzilla are called kings, right? So there's the, obviously King Kong, Godzilla, he's early got this moniker, the King of the Monsters, whatever.
And that was one of these subtitles. Yeah,
it was. It was the American version of the 1954 flick where when it got, you know, ported over to America, they gave it that moniker. And so in 2019, when they use that title again, they're taking that from the 54 American version. I guess that one came out like 55.
Is that one just a straight up remake of the 54? Like, is that what it was supposed to be?
No, I think that it's a continuation of the 2014 movie, but it's an homage. But it's very different. It's very different from either the American or the Japanese version.
It's kind of like how every zombie movie has to have a reference to Night of the Living Dead. Like,
yeah, a little bit.
Which I mean, because I actually watched that one, but the most recently, like after all the other zombie, you know, properties and stuff. And so it was kind of funny to see that and be like, oh, I remember seeing that reference, or oh, that reference makes sense now.
Sure.
But
One of the things that's interesting about the King Kong flick, especially the '30s, and then with, you know, Peter Jackson, the director of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So there's our, you know, Lord of the Rings reference all the way down.
Check that off the bingo card. Yeah, finally. Right. I was sweating.
It's been a while since we actually got that one, right? Feels like. But his favorite movie of all time is King Kong from 1933. And so after he delivered on this Lord of the Rings trilogy, the studio's like, what do you want to do next? Blank check. He's like, I want to do a King Kong. And so that's where the 2005 King Kong comes from. And what's fascinating about it, if you watch the 30s King Kong, it's a very pulpy adventure story, but it also is a movie about making a movie. And there's something super meta narrative about that.
Hollywood can't help itself when it comes to that. It's like,
well, that's true. But it's like kind of interesting.
How many protagonists of novels have to be writers, and how many, you know, movies have to be about making movies? It's like, let's watch La La Land and Babylon too. That's another movie about that whole kind of thing. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, but what's interesting about both movies, now in the 30s one, it's kind of more subtle. It's not, it's still primarily kind of a pulp fiction adventure story about exploring, you know, the world is shrinking. It's like the Industrial Revolution and the new globalization and modernity is kind of removing all the enchantment from reality and things like that. And, you know, King Kong is best understood as kind of like a modern fairy tale. And I mean that in the sense of like how fairy tales would have felt to like a medieval listener. In other words, in the modern age, our fairy tales have to do with like intrepid explorers and scientists going out to the unknown and like conquering nature kind of
thing.
Well,
it's sort of isn't it like Golden Fleece kind of story? That King Kong, doesn't it kind of strike you as a little bit of that?
Well, especially, I mean, I would say, yeah, okay. Yeah, I could say that. The idea is that, like, they go out and they bring back the treasure, right? Well, in this case, the treasure is this numinous creature, you know, King Kong, this eighth wonder of the world. Of the world, right? Like, he's a wonder, you know, he's full of wonderment, and he's meant to, you know, kind of like remind humans that they're kind of small compared to like these mighty creature kind of stuff.
And yeah, in a world that has lost wonder. And that's, so that's the significance thing too.
Well, and all these lost world stories are all, they're always, what they have in common is that like the places that the explorers venture to are places out of time. And so they've retained all the creatures and the ecosystems of, you know, millions of years ago, right? And so the immensity of the time scale is vast, right? And then the creatures and the fauna and the flora that live there are vast and big and things like that. So it's this kind of like scientistic numinous kind of thing where it's and I'm not even trying to degrade it. I really enjoy these stories. In fact, I think that there's a clue how we as humans now can regain a sense of like wonder and enchantment by returning to a more Jules Verne type style of
a desire mystery. For the transcendent, even amongst the materialists, right? Is that the materialist can't shake the desire for it, even through the lens that they see the only possibility for transcendence, which in this case, it's outside of time because, well, time still has that sort of material reality. Well, it happened 70 years ago or 1,000 years ago or something, but it still has enough reality to that person who has rejected the spiritual.
And so it's always in the Kong style of narrative, it's always going to the edge of the world, or in some cases going underneath the world, right? Going into the underworld, you know, again, all very fairy story, right? But it's always about finding the unknown. We're going to go find the unknown. And obviously the through line, what makes Godzilla an inversion of that 20 years later is post-World War II, post Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now the unknown is terrifying, right? Before it
and
was,
it's coming
it
to
was,
us. It's on the move, right?
Yeah. Well, and we go, and so in Kong's case, we go out.
We bring it.
You know,
yeah.
man conquers nature, right? So like, man goes out into nature, finds wonder there, and then bottles it and brings it back to civilization so they can sell it for money.
Pays paradise what I mean? And puts it in parking lot.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, and so. And then what happens, though, is the wonder gets loose and it wreaks havoc and chaos and whatever. And so, you know, we talked about how these creatures are like gods, right? Like kings, King Kong, you know, ancient people, their kings were gods, you know, small g gods or whatever. And so the idea that we use these king monikers for these two creatures, it's not a stretch to point out that, you know, they're worshipped like even in the Godzilla universe, you know, characters like Mothra have a pagan worship relationship with like their island communities, right? So this theme of these creatures being godlike creatures is very textual in all of these stories. But what's it sound like to you when I tell you about small g gods coming to humanity and, you know, giving them knowledge and technology or being ultimately destructive for... Wait. The human condition.
Is that Jonathan Peugeot I see through my screen? Yeah. Is that yeah, who is that? Is Jacob? Still here, or did he? Yeah, did he transubstantiate into somebody else?
Laura's beards too. You know, I'll take Father Stephen DeYoung.
Oh man, but if only.
Yeah, I know, right?
If only, yeah,
yeah. So anyway, all of these themes of going out into basically the edge of the world for high adventure and bringing back enchantments or whatever, but also simultaneously killing it, because that's also the thing that happens is like when you explore it, when you bottle it, you kill it. And that's King Kong, you know, it's doomed. It's a tragedy.
There's no mystery anymore. You've put brackets around
you've
it.
You've killed it.
You've defined it, which means of limits. You've limited it.
Yeah. And Peter Jackson's movie from 2005, this was a movie that got mixed reviews. And I don't think it's perfect. I think it's a little too long. I think that like there's reasons why people can criticize this movie. But the more I've rewatched it, the more I've really come around on it and think that it's actually a pretty, really great philosophical reflection on all kinds of stuff in unexpected ways. Because like you have all those themes that were present in 1933. But Peter Jackson really puts him front and center. And so whereas in 1933, Carl Denham is the filmmaker, he's like a safari styled guy. You know, he's a filmmaker, but he's more like a dude with an elephant gun going out to like film, you know, animal pictures, and because it's adventurous and he's like a manly man and things like that, right? Whereas Jack Black's character in the 2005 flick, he's kind of a psychopath. And it's basically, there's like a lot of commentary in the 2005 one where he's ruminating on the idea of like, do movies kill magic? And does filmmaking, you know, these movies are here to bring magic to you. But the actual system of producing movies is monstrous, basically. So he's got some really kind of like, you know, but it's like, Peter Jackson, what are you trying to say? Well, you know, like when you're a filmmaker in this movie, is someone who's a charlatan, and he'll basically put anyone's life on the line or his obsession.
He points one finger at us, but he's pointing three fingers back at himself the whole time.
You know.
Now I want to say, so like one of the things that is interesting about, and Peter Jackson, like this is consistent with his Lord of the Rings movie trilogy, is he's, and I have seen that King Kong movie, actually, the Peter Jackson one, is he's really good at the romantic. And I don't mean romantic in terms of sexual. I mean romantic in terms of high idealistic, right? Like,
100%. And
he does that so well in Lord of the Rings, which is why people weep, they sob at the Lord of the Rings movies, even if they haven't read the book, even if they're not, you know, Christian or Catholic, they don't get those connections. They still can see they want so badly the ideals of Aragorn or of Frodo and Sam, right? The friendship and all that stuff. And so like, and it's the same, you know, it's similar thematically in Kong when it comes to the romantic. And I don't just mean Kong liking the girl, right? And picking up the girl. I mean the, you know, isn't there the line that it was beauty that killed the beast? Or that's from the original. I don't know if they use that in the new one.
It is, yeah. No, there's a made up, it's a made up, you know, Arabian proverb or whatever. You know, the beast looked upon the face of beauty, and from that day on, it was as one dead. Or something like that, which sounds old and cool, you know, but yeah, they just made that up.
And it does resonate actually with, I mean, classical philosophy and Catholic theology. And I would imagine Orthodox theology too, where, you know, when we talk about the transcendentals, that God isn't just another beautiful thing or something that participates in beauty, but beauty itself. And we know going back to the Old Testament, you couldn't look upon the face of God and live. You can look at beautiful things, right? Things that only share in God's beauty, but aren't beauty itself, because it will kill you, right? It's a death by holiness, to quote our favorite podcast, Lord of Spirits, right? So there you go, you get another. So it's like, it's the same kind of idea where, in the, like you said, whether it's made up or a real proverb, in this sense, it's a King Kong proverb, that you look upon beauty and, you know, it will kill you, not in like the bad sense, but like you will give your life to, you'll sacrifice your life for beauty. And now you can be wrong about what that beautiful thing is. Like, we can have a mistaken notion of God, but when we are captivated by beauty, we can't help but give our lives to it.
Well, there might be actually some through lines, because where I wanted to go, I'm going to say a few more things about Kong, but I want to get to the 2019 Godzilla King of the Monsters movie, because there's a ton of stuff to talk about that movie. But one of the through lines is that you have characters. All right. So in the Peter Jackson King Kong, the Denim character is someone who's obsessed with bringing magic to the masses, kind of thing, by being a great man, you know, by using his powers of technology and persuasion and filmmaking to really show the world how cool he is and things like that. And so on the one hand, there is actually something commendable about wanting to bring wonder to people. But if your heart's in the wrong place, you know, it can be pretty bad. In the King of the Monsters movie from 2019, you have that same idea where there's an organization called Monarch that is basically enigmatic. Sometimes they're good guys, sometimes they're bad guys, frankly, but they're full of people who are trying to do the right thing anyway. But some of those people end up doing the wrong thing because they're doing it out of a place of respect.
Wink, wink. What's it called again?
You know, yeah, right.
I know,
but they're doing it in a bad way, and it leads to destruction and things like that. So, yeah, if you try to play with God like a toy, you know, this all the idea, like, it actually kind of reminded me of like Ananias and Sapphira out of the Book of Acts. Mm. It's not quite the same thing, because they weren't trying to like make money off the church per se, but it's this kind of crass, you know, you're bringing the idea of like your own personal desires and your own personal gain, and you're approaching God with it.
And I think it's, you know, because you put Tower of Babel, which on the outline, and that I think is very fitting too, right? Because the idea is, you know, you have, what was the Tower of Babel? It was a big ziggurat, which wasn't just a tower for a tower's sake. It was a temple. And the thing about that too, that is never really considered, but like God, like, because what do you have at the top of a temple? You have the altar, right? That's the meeting place between humanity and God. And so God comes down to our level at the point of sacrifice at the altar. But the thing about that is what made the tower problematic, like I said, wasn't just the people are getting too big for their britches. It was that they were trying to, by creating the tower themselves, because God had already given us raised spaces on the earth, right? God has already given us mountains. And so our participation in that was by walking up the mountain, which has always had a connection to pilgrimage and spiritual growth in Christian history. We're supposed to meet God by the means that God has given us. God already gave us the altar at the top of the mountain, but when we try to create our own, then it's like us putting God in a box, or us meeting God on our terms and not God's terms. And that's chaining up Kong. That's chaining up, you know, the monster.
There is some interesting, you know, one of the things I kind of briefly touched on this a little bit ago. Kong has a really interesting, like, relationship with humanity, right? So, and you could almost get a little bit of a kind of Christological nuance here. To not be, you know, too superficial, but like he, on the one hand, he's the most human of these numinous creatures, and the one that has the most direct relationship with humanity and whatnot. But on the other hand, he is inhuman, and he is bigger than humanity, and he's not. So you kind of have a dual nature. And not just in the creature, like not necessarily in the stories per se, but in how the story, like the actual animal Kong, I'm not saying as a dual nature, but the story treatment of Kong as a dual narrative about who that creature is to humanity.
It's and a liminal space too, because it's like the most evolved of the apes, but not quite human too. So it's in that space where it's a transition point. So that's where you get a little bit of both too.
Well, and so to really kind of slather on the Christological references here, you're talking about the Tower of Babel, right? And you're talking about what's at the top of towers, but the sacrificial place, right? Well, so what does a cat just interrupted me? what does Kong do at the end? He climbs the tallest building in town. He climbs the highest building that we've constructed. And that's our Tower of Babel too. Skyscrapers are civilization. They're the high place of civilization or whatever.
Who's our God, right? Our God is money in this. It's
100% all there. And what happens? He climbs to the top and then he dies. He's sacrificed. Modernity comes swinging in on biplanes, World War I era biplanes, and the modern world kills the eighth wonder of the world, this enchanted creature, and he falls. And it was, you know, going also, tying this all back into the whole beauty killed the beast thing, the only reason any of this even happens is because Kong is enamored with the girl, right? But the only reason the girl is even there is because the audiences demand it. So in the 33 version, and I also am pretty sure in the 2005 version too, they say the same thing. But there's a point where like Carl Denham has all this animal footage. And they're like, we don't want animal footage. We want a girl. We want a love interest. We want romance to, you know, not the high romance that you were talking about, but even the superficial romance. The reason why they share the word is because there is a level of highness to both personal
in our human
romance
experience, it's the thing that pulls us out of ourselves most easily or most.
Right, exactly. Right? Yeah, it's adventurous.
And there was a
reason
why, like in ancient, you know, pagan societies too, and this is why you'd have like the temple prostitutes, and you'd have like, they saw it as a sort of ecstasy, right? The marital act, to, you know, put a fine term on it. They saw it as a sort of ecstasy where you were raised up out of yourself. And you were brought to, in a sense, the place of the gods, which, I mean, that can be seen as very crass, which obviously can be taken to be very crass, but in the best sense of the term, like, there is something to that. Like, we didn't just make this up, you know, right now. No, this has always kind of been there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, beauty, this idea that he is sacrificed to the masses, like for the masses, so that they can experience wonder. Right. And it's at this Tower of Babel type experience or whatever. I do think that the symbolism is getting a little mixed up and jumbled in the sense that it's not necessarily like a good or a bad continuity, but the elements are there. The visual elements are there. And they do invoke these themes, right? Mm. By the time you get to Godzilla 20 years later, after World War II has happened and things like that, you know, the enchantment's broken. Like, now the only thing left for people to find is destruction at the hand of, like, scientists. You know, it's interesting that Oppenheimer, you know, was one of the biggest movies last year. I recently watched that. If you watch the 54 Godzilla, both the American and the Japanese one, Dr. Serizawa is a character in that. He's also got a cool eye patch. So I don't know why they didn't put a cool eye patch on Ken Watanabe.
Okay, somebody on YouTube should, like, splice together clips from Oppenheimer and Godzilla and, like, just to sort of make this point of, like, yeah, it's all the same movie. It's all the same story.
Well, and you know? So Serizawa in the 54 movie, he's an Oppenheimer stand-in. He has a new destructive weapon that could kill, you know, bajillions of people. It's the oxygen destroyer. And so they actually nod to that too in the 2019 flick. It's what they used to kill Godzilla in that one. This oxygen destroyer is basically a stand-in for the A-bomb. And in that movie, Serizawa, he can't allow that technology to be used as a weapon, right? He's not trying to create a weapon. He's trying to create it to, you know, harness oxygen or something like that. But, like, instead, he finds out how to destroy oxygen.
That's every science gone wrong story,
yeah,
right?
I
just wanted to create a cure for Alzheimer's. Oh, now you have a planet run by apes. It's like,
right.
Well, hey, no, that's in a couple of weeks. We can't talk about that one.
We're going to get to that one.
That'll be an episode in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And so he actually ends up dying with they use it to kill Godzilla in 54, but he sacrifices his life with it because he doesn't want to be Oppenheimer. So, like, you know, contrasting the biography of Oppenheimer with this Japanese fairy tale from 1954, which they have an Oppenheimer stand-in, is kind of interesting to watch. But yeah, now it's the Atom Age, the Atomic Age, and all these big monster movies are going to start happening in the 50s and, you know, kind of into the 60s. It's all about how, oh, we've opened Pandora's box.
Oh my gosh!
You know, science.
The fact that there's like a million monster movies. That's like the proliferation of nuclear weapons, Jacob.
Every country has to
have
one.
Yeah, every country has to have 500 monster movies now, because just like every country has to have a bunch of nukes.
Yes, giant radioactive creatures because of the atomic age.
So what's the mutually assured destruction? Nobody makes any more monster movies to prevent. Yeah, like all the other countries
that would make me sad.
Doing it.
You know, it is interesting. I don't really have much to talk about in the context of this conversation. But the other movie that came out last year was Godzilla Minus One, which is another movie title that just like,
gosh, I forgot another math
no
problem.
Sense.
It's like minus one times Kong equals. Yeah,
I don't get it. But like, don't even get me started on Godzilla Minus One's movie title. Anyway, it's a reboot. So it's not in continuity with any others, and it takes place actually in the 40s. And so it's much closer to World War II, and it's about World War II as such. And it's very much, it's great. It's a really good movie, but it's about the glorification of war being a bad thing. And how, you know, the ultimate theme is it's greater to live for your country than it is to die for your country, things like that. Which, again, all of these Godzilla movies are always social commentary, especially the Godzilla franchise. And so, depending upon if you're watching a movie from the 70s, it's going to be talking about pollution. If you're watching a movie circa 2023.
Or overpopulation, right? Soylent Green?
Yeah. That's true. But these Godzilla movies specifically, though, there's like 20
I guess
of them, right?
Pollution and overpopulation kind of went hand in hand. So, sorry
let
to
me,
derail.
No. Let me just hammer home how real this is, though. Like, this is honestly like, what Japanese directors did for most of Godzilla's history is like, what's popular in movies these days? Let's make a Godzilla movie out of it. So if you go and you watch, you know, Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla from like 1973 or something like that, the bad guys in that movie are talking apes, because Planet of the Apes was really popular at the time. And so they took Planet of the Apes and they turned it into a Godzilla. Yeah, it's shameless. It's shameless. All of their movies are like that.
So what we need is an AI Godzilla, like either a virtual Godzilla that, you know.
Well,
like,
and so, Shameless might, like, sometimes it's shameless. Sometimes it's poignant. You know, like Shin Godzilla, that's the one that came out, I don't know, about 10 years ago. But that was a direct commentary on the nuclear, remember that kind of tragedy in
Chernobyl?
No, it was in Japan. It was like, 2009 or something like that. And it was a big deal. I was in Hawaii at the time. So I was close enough, like we're kind of, like, we were worried that radiation was going to, like, a radiation cloud was going to, like, hit Hawaii. So, like, it was kind of local news for us. But it was a really big deal for Japan. And so then they made a Godzilla movie, right? And now in 2023, their movie is about, like, Japan wrestling with its history. Because obviously, the Japanese Empire that, you know, led to World War II and things like, or was involved with Japan's, you know, relationship to World War II, you know, kind of dark. And so it's this kind of, like, historical wrestling.
You can see how, like, the legacy. Seeds for its destruction were sort of sown, you know, in previous generations. Kind of what they're reckoning.
Well, they were just like extremely militaristic, and they were extremely kind of like collectivists, you know, so kamikazes, right? And the Godzilla Minus One, its main character is a kamikaze pilot that doesn't kill himself. Okay. And so it actually becomes this really, really pro-life movie. And it's a movie about, like, you know, living is more important than dying and things like that. It's pretty interesting, frankly, and pretty poignant. So yeah, go check out Godzilla Minus One. There's a reason why people like it. It's been a really popular one. But that's not the one I want to talk about right now. We're going to go to the 2019 King of the Monsters and explore some of the themes of that. Did you ever read Planet Narnia?
Yeah.
Do you remember Donna Gallaty? Donna Gallaty is a term that, C.S. Lewis, I think C.S. Lewis referenced it, and then the author of Planet Narnia uses it to explain basically the vibes. Donna Gallaty is basically just an old-fashioned word for the vibe something.
Okay.
Just kind of like the feel of it. What it kind of like emanates or invokes the spirit of a thing. And so Planet Narnia goes through all the different Narnia novels and talks about how they invoke the seven planets, right? So Jupiter and all that stuff. And it's not so much the story or any one thing. It's more just like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And it invokes this type of feel in the reader, right? Godzilla King of the Monsters has a Donna Gallaty about it. And it's about... It's a religious movie. And I don't think I've heard too many people comment on this. Let me tell you, you want your perfect Easter movie?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's not Passion of the Christ. It's Godzilla, King of the Monsters from 2019. Forget Ben-Hur, Mike. We've got a new staple for the Easter season.
Because I know... Yeah, so we Westerners are in the Easter season right now, and you're, how close are you? Well, and actually, today, so normally we would celebrate the Solemnity of the Annunciation, right? Which, in the East, you guys celebrate that as well on March 25th, right?
Yeah.
Or no? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we already did it.
So, for us, it was happening during Holy Week, because it was leading up to...
Oh, and so you had to push it.
So we actually moved it. So we moved it to the next available non-Solemnity, which this past week was Easter week. So the entire week is a solemnity, the octave. So today is actually the Feast of the Annunciation, even though normally it would be March. So happy Annunciation to you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It sounds like
happy Annunciation to me.
Sounds like your guys' calendar is really messed up. Like, I think, I don't know.
As it, guys... if it isn't obvious, we do what we want with our calendar, with the calendar, not with our calendar. Our calendar makes it sound too, like, too exclusive. It's the calendar. We do what we want with the calendar.
What, just because you're like we more are, accurate to the rotation around the sun, you think you're better than us?
We are the lords of time. Oh, we are the lord of time.
Nice, nice. All right, so
as, anyway, you were saying Godzilla King of Monsters, perfect Easter movie. You thought you were going to have the hottest take, but yeah. I had to top it. So
Michael Doherty is actually a filmmaker I really, really enjoy. He was given the reins for the Godzilla franchise in America. They call it the Monsterverse. It started in 2014. Gareth Edwards, who's also a pretty prestigious director, did a pretty interesting introduction to a new take, a new modern American take on Godzilla. But 2019 is, that one was more like Jaws, if Jaws was like a giant radioactive lizard. And so he's not even really in the movie all that much, Godzilla, right? And it's very down to earth and very realistic. And he was trying to like make a movie that's like, what would it feel like to the average person for this to happen? And as such, it actually has a lot more in common with something like King Kong, because it really is about this creature from the depths coming up and just showing humanity something numinous. And all of the framing is all from the human level. So like you're constantly looking at Godzilla as if he's like a living mountain, just like moving through the landscape. And we're all just like, you know, it's almost like Cthulhu-esque. Like we're just small compared to these like vast elemental figures in the universe that, you know, we're just tiny.
You mentioned Titans, right? Very much a Clash of the Titans when the other monsters come in too.
Well, this is so Titans. So none of that's the 2014 Gareth Edwards one, which is still a good movie. Go check it out. It does the numinous really well. But 2019's Godzilla King of the Monsters is where Michael Doherty takes this idea and he wants to turn textually. He wants to turn these creatures into gods, right? And so he adopts his script, his movie. This is the first time that the kaiju, to use the Japanese word for these giant monsters, are referred to as titans in this new monster verse. And he is literally calling them titans because he's taking that from the Greek mythology. He wants to identify these giant creatures that are starting to rise up from, you know, different places around the world with the titans of Greek mythology, who were these kind of like proto gods, these elemental gods that, you know, the quote unquote, like new gods like Zeus or Aphrodite or whatever came and fought against and replaced, you know, not so much Aphrodite, but Zeus for sure. But he's going back to like basically everything in the movie. They're constantly referencing mythology and they're constantly pointing out that like, oh, this is the foundation for this story. This is the like it was all real. All the myths were rooted in reality. And there was this relationship that humans had with these god creatures that roamed the earth.
Is 100% unironically like true. So it's like,
yeah, no, it is. It's paganism. Only, you know, instead of it being a kind of like possession thing, there's actually like, you know, giant creatures, right? Which again, very King Kong like as well, because that's his relationship to the inhabitants of Skull Island in the 30s movie and in the 2005 flick. You know, they worship him, they offer him sacrifices, you know, and things like that. It's just paganism on display. In the King of the Monsters movie, there is this organization called Monarch, and Monarch wants to coexist with these creatures. And it's got different types of people within it, but one of those people is Serizawa. They take that name from the old 54 movie, but he's almost like an apostle. Like he spends his entire life just trying to like convince people that we should like enter into relationship with these new gods and you know, they're here to make our world better and we have to like work with them and things like that. But then you also have skeptics like the other main character in the movie whose name is Mark, who his family, his son is killed in the events of the 2014 movie. And so he's someone who sees Godzilla as this like uncaring monster, right? That is nothing but destruction. He's basically someone who has experienced suffering and like rejected God. Because how could a good God allow so much suffering to occur?
Or even somebody who has a traumatic experience with religion in their past, you know, and whatever.
So. Right. And then his wife, Emma, who's another one of the main characters, they end up getting a divorce in the aftermath of the loss of their son.
This is Bryan Cranston, right?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to picture it.
She actually ends up, the movie reveals that she does want to embrace the new gods, so to speak, but she wants to do it in a way that's going to unleash them and kind of like bring balance back to humanity's relationship with nature real quick. In other words, just let the monsters rage all over the world. And yeah, billions of people will die, but in the end, we'll have a good ecosystem. So it's like Thanos all over again. She's taking the Thanos option.
It's letting nature sort of run wild, or
right,
I guess. Okay.
So whereas the Serizawa crowd are more inclined to try to, you know, evolve into a relationship with the Titans, you know, bring back something that what it used to be, but do it smartly and strategically. She just wants to unleash the Kraken, right? Mm-hmm. And like, and so that's what she does. And she and her crew of eco terrorists go and unleash this monster Zero, King Ghidorah, who is like Godzilla's arch nemesis from all the different movies across time, who is a snake-like, dragon-like figure who it's revealed isn't even from planet Earth. He's an alien monster. And so he's literally called a false king, a false Christ by Serizawa. He's Antichrist, right? Because Serizawa, he spends the entire movie talking about Godzilla reverentially as someone who's come to humanity in order to like save humanity. And Ghidorah, it's shown, is someone who just wants to destroy humanity. He's not interested in a relationship with humanity at all. He just wants to destroy everything. And so here's the thing. The humans, like the human governments or whatever, they don't know what to do with all this. So they just decide to try to kill everybody, including Godzilla. So they end up killing Godzilla halfway through this movie with their oxygen destroyer. And then Godzilla has to come back from the dead. Like,
what?
He has to come back to the dead via the fate of Serizawa.
Since Ghidorah is from space, it doesn't need oxygen. So the oxygen destroyer doesn't work.
He's the foundation for the Hydra myth. And so, you know how Hydra, like you cut his head off and another one grows back kind of thing. Okay. He's got like Wolverine X-Men powers where like he constantly like self heals. Mm-hmm. And so their explanation is that the oxygen destroyer can't kill him fast enough. So he just regenerates. He's constantly regenerating. And so it doesn't work on him. So the only thing they managed to do is betray and kill the Godzilla messianic.
So Godzilla died because of our sins.
That's true.
Now
we did a real Judas
back.
Thing. There's like the Judas betrayal with Godzilla. Yeah. And so what happens is, meanwhile, you have this big commentary going on between Mark the skeptic and Serizawa, the kaiju apostle. And Serizawa's like, you just have to have faith, man. Like, sometimes you have to understand that there are things bigger than you and you can't always understand it. And moments of crisis can be moments to practice having faith that there are things that are bigger than you and that you have to trust those things. And he gives this big faith speech to Mark halfway through the movie. And it's right after that Mothra, who's called the Queen of the Monsters, which just kind of reminds me of like Queen of Heaven type stuff.
The Queen Mother. The Queen Mother.
And she does have, the movie details that there is a symbiotic relationship between Mothra and Godzilla. Like they have their own symbiotic relationship that the movie gets into. But she comes in like Google it sometime. It's like light. It's this overwhelming glory where she comes in right as Mark's about to leave because he doesn't know what to do anymore, kind of thing. And he has this vision, this beatific vision of Mothra come in. And the movie puts a lot of emphasis on this moment. It's like his, like, it's what breaks his skepticism. And it's the beauty of Mothra that opens his eyes to, like, her benevolence and how these creatures aren't here as uncaring, you know, mass destruction monsters.
Well, and
but
if you
actually
compare
here to, like, help humanity.
That winged creature with the other one. You know, the one has the dragon bat-like wings, whereas Mothra is going to have the more bird-like angelic wings. And so it would kind of fit, right?
Of course, she's a butterfly, right?
And you have to know who's the good guy and the bad guy coming back to life.
Resurrection, she's a resurrection symbol. And that's going to play into things, right? So what she does, when she shows up and Mark sees her, she actually, like, she has a symbol being sent to Godzilla. So turns out Godzilla's not full dead. You know, Princess Bride style, he's only mostly dead. And so Mothra has this relationship where she can kind of, like, you know, heal Godzilla. It's going to take too long. And so they have to go and deliver a nuclear radiation filled, because they eat radiation. That's like their food source or something like that. Don't think about it. They have to go deliver a nuclear warhead to Godzilla so that he gets, like, super healthy, like steroids, because it's going to take too long for him to recuperate.
It's mythological though, because in the same way that, like, you know, bearing the weight of our sins or whatever, well, that's the radiation caused by nuclear power, nuclear war. And now it's consuming it. It's taking it in. And in a sense, that's what makes the quote unquote grace, according to this movie, possible.
You know what? I hadn't really thought about that. That's pretty good though. So
there you go.
Sarazawa goes in. Another thing about the Donegality of this movie is that, like, martyrdom and self-sacrifice is constant throughout it. So Sarazawa volunteers his life to go deliver this warhead to, you know, the messianic figure that he's faithful to. And they supercharge Godzilla with the warhead, and he shows back up, and he goes into one big final fight with Ghidorah, where Mothra shows up and she has to sacrifice herself in order to give him the last of her strength so that he can get superpowered by Mothra. And then Emma, the woman who wanted to unleash chaos on the world, but now she's repented and seen the error of her ways, she sacrifices herself in order to, you know, lead Ghidorah away from her family. So everyone is just martyring themselves, like, left and right in this movie. And it's basically just one big story about sacrifice and redemption and Godzilla coming back from the dead to save us from Satan. And it's an underworld motif because he's going to recuperate is literally under the ocean in Atlantis. That's where, like, his thing is. So
it's just it's pulling at everything. It's just a pastiche, as you want to say.
Yeah, that's that Donegality thing that I was talking about.
I was actually going to mention, when you mentioned, is it Ghidorah? I want to make sure I say it right. It actually is reminiscent of, and I'm probably thinking about this more so because we're actually going through Dante's Divine Comedy in my classes right now. And the depiction of the devil at the bottom of Inferno, at the bottom of hell, he retains his angelic nature when he fell, right? He was created as an angel or as a seraph, and then he chose not to serve God. He fell from heaven. He retained it. So he still has his wings, but they're not angelic wings. They're bat wings. And because his desire was to be worshiped as God. So in a sense, he was trying to take the divine nature in the same way that he tempted Adam and Eve to take of the fruit, take grasp of the divine nature. In a sense, he got what he wanted. So how is he depicted in Dante? He has three faces, right? Or three sort of heads. It's really three faces.
Yeah, you're right.
Because he wanted the Trinity, right? He wanted the Trinitarian life, but he wanted it on his terms, or he wanted it through the lens of power. And so in the same way that, and I talk to my students about this, where it's like, you know, he wanted godness and God showed him what it was, which is humility and allowing yourself to be consumed, whether it's consumed by the violence of the world or consumed in the Eucharist. And he said, no, I want it, but I want to be the consumer. And so what is he doing at the bottom of hell? He is eternally consuming the souls of, you know, sinners, right? And he's flapping his wings because he wants to raise himself up to the heights. but it's his flapping of the wings, which is what is freezing the waters of Cocytus, which is keeping him in hell.
You know, another parallel is especially in the 2019 movie, Ghidorah is a storm god in like the ancient Baal? Near Eastern sense. Yeah, like Baal. Yeah. And so like he is constantly surrounded by hurricane winds. And as he flies around, he's basically, hurricane storms.
It's almost like you see all of these and you're almost like, how is this? I mean, it's like the God, it's like the pre-gospel. It's seeds of the word.
He was frozen in Antarctica on the bottom of the earth. That's where he was.
Jacob, when they had to release these movies, and yet I'm like walking you through it. Like you're just telling me.
Yeah, I know.
You're
the one pulling up the. Well, yeah, I didn't think about the Satan Dante thing.
Honestly, I was going to joke with you when you said, have you read the Planet Narnia? And I was like, well, yeah, but I've also read what Planet Narnia, because Lewis was influenced by Dante.
Oh, right? Yeah.
He was very much a medievalist in his, writing and in his structure. So he creates those seven planets according to the, the seven planets of the medieval mind, which is what Dante does for his view of heaven.
Cool.
So which is exactly what Michael Ward does in the Planet Narnia book.
Yeah. So Ghidorah is... Yeah, super Satan figure.
Dante's the devil. Dante. Ghidorah is the devil. Yeah, exactly.
Most definitely.
So what I'm saying is you don't need to watch the Godzilla. You just need to read Dante, which, okay.
You can do both.
You can watch. Yeah, you can do both. I shouldn't be like, you can do both.
Oh, and I'll throw in a 30-second review of the new Godzilla versus Kong movie. I didn't like it as much as Godzilla versus Kong. It was okay.
We could have recorded this episode without you watching Godzilla X Kong because we talked about all the other stuff. But I mean, that's fine because it all corresponds.
The last couple of movies have been super Hollow Earth based, and that's all very underworld stuff.
That's also Dante. That's what Inferno is under the.
It's crazy. It's crazy how rich in symbolism these movies are
it all rhymes, right? It's not that anybody's copying each other. It's that they all rhyme.
Right.
And they do it. I mean, they do it in a way that resonates with people.
King Kong has to go fight an evil version of himself who was enslaved like an ape race down in the Hollow Earth. And he controls an ice monster. So the evil Kong is called Scar. And Scar.
Bizarro Kong, I think is what.
Yeah, he's like Bizarro Kong. Yeah. But he actually controls an ice creature that can like freeze things. So if you want some more Divine Comedy references.
Well, and that's St. Paul, right? That we were once slaves to sin, sort of.
In the kingdom that the evil Kong lives in, it's like a flame hellish kingdom.
This is like, it's like the people who, these are supposedly non-Christians who make this, and yet they are presenting the gospel in a way that's more compelling than 90% of the homilies that
gets there, like they discover an ancient civilization of humans that are still worshiping gods. And Mothra has to come back and like also help everyone. So you got the beatific vision. She's golden this time. So she's like glowing all golden and stuff like that. And so Kong and Godzilla and Mothra team up to defeat the evil Ice King.
Is that three of them? Did you say you just have three of them?
Well, there's Kong, Godzilla, and Mothra.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's the triumvirate.
There's three, trifecta. There's yeah, exactly.
I think would Kong be the son and then Godzilla the father? No, anyway.
Kong has a son in this movie, but
Okay, so you were all like, look at how Christological King Kong and Godzilla are. You can say that to me, but have you suggested to your pastor that your pastor go watch Godzilla for Holy Week? Or like maybe you'll have a screening.
We should cancel services and just like have a showing of Godzilla
for Vespers this evening. We're gonna have a showing.
We're gonna update things,
For the kids, for the youths.
I'll call it the Norbis Ordo service.
Ooh, shots fired.
All right, man. I guess we better wrap it up, huh?
No, this is good. I was almost thinking, we could go long and that'll be kind of fun, but no, this is good. Yeah, no, thanks. And I guess, for me, it's already passed. But for you, Pascha is coming up. So maybe for your Holy Week in Pascha, you can watch Godzilla again. And you'll just have to remind me next year. So
that's true.
But yeah, thank you guys for joining us for this episode of the Voyage Podcast. And as always, just want to encourage you guys to like, subscribe, leave a 5-star rating, positive review, wherever you're listening to it, just to kind of get episodes like this. And we won't make 5 million monster episodes, I promise, even though there's 5 million monster movies. But
there's what?
just to get those out there, is get all these episodes out there as much as you can. So thanks again, Jacob.
Thanks for listening to Voyage Podcast. The Voyage Podcast is a production of Voyage Comics and Publishing, which seeks to create exceptional entertainment informed by Catholic values that inspire people to live a heroic life. Voyage Comics seeks to advance truth and beauty found in powerful stories. To learn more, visit voyagecomics.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram